Thank you. Yes, Anna has given you a good overview of how the Atlas works, all the nuts and bolts of it, and what work we're doing on it at the moment. And if you want to know more, I want to thank the World Oral Literature Project for having ready in time this occasional paper that I've written for them about the Atlas and the context and method, as it's called. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to see it actually ready and in my hands and in your hands, I hope. That'll give you some more background information about the Atlas. I think Anna had said everything that needs to be said about the workings of the Atlas. Just one thing I wanted to add, actually. I think if you go online to the online version, you see, is it 2,473 languages we've got? That's the total number we've got at the moment. Compared to the earlier figures, the figures from the earlier editions that Anna had just mentioned. So, I was actually going to present you some visual aspects as well. I was going to give you a couple of tables, but I seem to have brought wrong versions of the files. But it doesn't matter, because I was going to talk you through these very simple tables anyway, and I can just as well do it orally. So, Charting Vanishing Voices. It's the main title of our workshop, and I like to think the collaborative goal here is to map endangered oral cultures. So this UNESCO Atlas of the World Languages in Danger isn't explicitly concerned with orality, but the work undertaken by this oral literature project who are our hosts here in Cambridge has forced me to think more particularly about the distinction between spoken and written language. Most linguists seem to have an implied belief in the primacy of spoken language over written language. And it seems axiomatic, doesn't it, that spoken language came before and always will come before written language. So, does that mean it should survive longer? Or rather, that spoken language is so resilient that being committed to writing makes no difference to its survival? I've been pondering about this issue lately. Perhaps it's more likely to be the case that once a language is committed to writing, the chances of survival are improved. Does vernacular literacy add any strength or resilience to a language, just because it can be communicated to readers who don't have to be present where and when it's written? That's the virtue of written language, isn't it? It distances you. It makes the language independent of space and time. So the UNESCO Atlas, as I say, is concerned with charting those languages that are under some degree of threat, and you've seen how that's done. And the data that's available in the online version about each individual language is mainly concerned with identifying it, locating it, quantifying its speakers, distinguishing them from other speakers. In the more general background text of the printed version, though, you can read about the language families to which they belong, their affiliations, and the kinds of threats they face in their particular region. So you can trace some of the general historic trends that have led to their present situation. So before exploring this topic with you, perhaps some general considerations about literacy. It might be worthwhile stopping and thinking about literacy. Firstly, who makes a speech community literate? The speakers of a small language. Literacy can't be a self-taught skill. There has to be some outside intervention. Over the centuries, small speech communities with no say in the central government that administers them have most often become literate through missionary activities. Missions will have been sent to the communities with the aim of converting the people to a religion, and that religion will have to be one that accepts that the sacred texts are not embodied in a sacred language, like classical Arabic, for instance, or Latin, but that the texts are a truth that can be translated. The missionaries must therefore be first trained in the community's language, and then be persuasive enough to create and apply an orthography, with or without consultation with the speakers. Secondly, that orthography must be practical. The distinction between describing a language as accurately as possible for the benefit of linguistic analysis and showing overtly as many distinctions as possible and inventing an easily learned writing system which respects the structure of the language. That's basically the difference between the phonetic and the phonemic approach, I suppose. I don't want to go into more detail about that here, except to say that the first approach is aimed at the linguists and the second approach is aimed at the speakers. That's pretty obvious. And the speakers, of course, potential readers and writers of their own language. So thirdly, the skill of reading and writing can become a political tool. Missionaries can be secular too. The teaching of literacy and alphabet creation, for instance, in the early years of the Soviet Union, to the smaller ethnic groups within it, was overtly for political ends, for example. And the legacy of that literacy work is still with us today in Russia and the now independent republics, and the less independent republics within Russia. But this in itself doesn't have a direct bearing on endangerment. At least I've seen no proof that it does. The source of the literacy is less important than the fact of keeping the readers and writers supplied with continued reasons to use and consume the language in writing, in its written form. And fourthly and lastly, another consideration about literacy. Vernacular literacy has to be sustainable. There have to be domains of continuous written use. Preparing a reading primer or a prayer book or a catechism or something like that is only the beginning of a process of making the users familiar and easy with the written word. It's a kind of launch pad, really, and it has to be accessible and cheap and part of an ongoing education system. Otherwise, literacy in small languages can just wither on the vine. So what I'm proposing to do here, I'm sort of considering possible further uses for the data set that we have in the Atlas. I want to check the languages listed in the UNESCO Atlas against the facts known about literacy in them. I'm omitting languages known to be extinct in my considerations, because as Anna had said, we do include some languages that were recently extinct. So we'll disregard those. Unless they're going to be revived, that's an issue for the future and not for present consideration. So the state of vernacular literacy in all languages is not yet possible to tell. But I find the entries in Ethnologue as a useful adjunct to the data in the Atlas. And recently, two contributing editors of Ethnologue, Gary Simons and Paul Lewis, they wrote a paper which reassessed the state of the world's endangered languages. It was called The World's Endangered Languages, a 20-year update. And they presented that at a symposium in Milwaukee last year. In it, they elaborated an expanded version of Joshua Fishman's graded intergenerational disruption scale, which appeared in 1991. Well, the 20 years and their 20-year update was not so much a reference to that, the creation of that scale by Fishman. It's more 20 years since the famous warning by Michael Krauss in Alaska about the rate of decline of threatened languages. So their own conclusions, these conclusions that Simons and Lewis put out last year in their paper, they're not as pessimistic as Krauss's were, and they point to a great variation in the general rate of decline from one continent to another. And this got me thinking. And since they refer to our own UNESCO Atlas and they compare their finer gradations with ours in a useful table, I can reproduce them. That was one of the tables I was going to show you, but I have it in front of me and I wanted to talk you through it anyway, orally. So they've created 10 levels, including some sub-levels. Most of them don't concern our Atlas because they're what UNESCO would consider safe languages. But I'll start at level naught. Level naught is international. That is, languages used in trade, knowledge exchange, international policy. And secondly, at grade one in their scale, is national languages. That is, official languages in use in all domains within a nation state. Again, no argument there that they're safe. Except possibly in the case of Belarus, but because actually Belarusian is in our Atlas, and I think it's one of those very rare cases. Oh, what's another one? Dzongkha in Bhutan. Belarus Belarusian and Dzongkha are actually national languages which are under threat. But I won't digress about those just yet. Then at level two, on their scale, their expanded scale, there's provincial. That's languages used in education, work, and everything that's under the control of provincial governments. And that also makes a language safe. And then what they call level three is languages of wider communication. Languages widely used in work and mass media, of course, without official status to transcend their use. Then at their level four, educational, a very important level, which also ensures that a language is safe. The language is in vigorous oral use and reinforced by sustainable transmission of literacy in the language in formal education. Most of what I've been trying to quantify here about literacy just implies education. I think of education as something implied in continued literacy in a vernacular. Then there's what they call developing as their level five, where the literacy isn't quite sustainable, but there are literacy campaigns going on in a regional or lower level language within a country. And then they have a sixth level, which they divide into 6A and 6B, and this is where our UNESCO Atlas kicks in. At 6A, vigorous use of a language, meaning it's used orally, perhaps more weak, perhaps not in any sustained form in writing, but the language is still more or less safe. And then you've seen the categories that UNESCO uses. This is where they start. This is from 6B, which they call threatened, and that is where the language is still used orally within all domains, but there is a significant threat to its continued use, and there aren't the motivations to continue using throughout the whole community the language orally, and certainly not in writing either. So that's what our atlas calls vulnerable, where these are the languages which are still relatively strong, but they need watching for the future. And then on this EGIDS scale, this expanded GIDS scale, their next level is shifting, and that is what we call in definitely endangered. It matches perfectly with definitely endangered in our colour coding system for marking languages in the atlas. And that's where the childbearing generation can still use the language, but they're not using it consistently and completely. So the language is starting to decline in use within the family. Then we get into the cases of serious threat, what they call moribund. They've divided their level 8 into 8A and 8B. Moribund would be the only remaining active speakers are in the older generation. They're not passing it on to the younger generation consistently. And that's what we call, in our atlas, severely endangered. Then they have a level 8B, which is nearly extinct. Critically endangered is what we would call it. I think that's self-evident what it's meant. You know, the language is very fragmented. People are starting to forget it. The whole general population is starting to forget the language and how to use it. And then we kind of sink below the waves at this point. They have a level 9, which is called dormant. And that is, there are no fully proficient speakers left, right? There's some symbolic use remaining as a reminder of heritage identity. And then last of all, extinct. They're level 10, which we also call extinct. In fact, we call 9 and 10 extinct. We did originally, but we've since developed these categories of revived and revitalized for languages where there are active campaigns to get the language going again in everyday use. So that's the scale. So what I did, inspired by this effort of theirs, I decided to create a general literacy scale of my own. And I worked it out by taking a sample of languages from the Atlas. Now, I've said that there are 2,473 in the atlas. I took a sample of 525 of them. I thought that was a fairly reasonable size sample to draw some conclusions from. Of course, I shouldn't assume that non-literate languages are rarer among the less endangered. I mean, you can look at it both ways. Is there anything inherently endangered about a non-written language? I don't think that would be true, because I took a further sample of another 268 languages from Ethnologue, which is about half the number I took from the Atlas, but also a reasonable chunk, that are not endangered and not in the Atlas, and I checked them on the graded literacy scale as well. And I divided them up by continent as well to see if there's much difference. So I've come to some tentative conclusions. First, let me tell you what I found for the sample of endangered languages from the Atlas. Checking these entries against the Ethnologue, giving entries for signs of literacy, vernacular literacy, I assumed that where it wasn't mentioned at all, that there is no literacy in if Ethnologue doesn't mention it. And I can also check that against my own Encyclopedia of Endangered Languages, which also mentions literacy factor where it's relevant. So that was what had been done in my encyclopedia as well. And I also assume that in the case of Ethnologue, where they talk about Bible portions or New Testament or Bible, that there is an orthography that's been created, and even if it isn't being applied to other things, at least it's acknowledged as the standard. What the figures don't show is use of literacy in the education system, and this is crucial. As I mentioned earlier, this is a crucial factor, but no source that I can find has enough consistent information about education, use in education, for me to be able to talk confidently of anything more than literacy. I'd rather just stick to literacy. And of course, it raises the question is, how far can you go in your vernacular? Can you go only through primary education and then go to a language of wider communication beyond that? Usually that's the case with small languages. Secondary and tertiary education tend not to be in the vernacular, except in some countries rich enough to support an education system that can take you right through. So, my own scale, just briefly to sum up here, is I created also a system of 9 separate elements in a scale. Firstly, grade 1 would be no literacy. Secondly, would be literacy only in language 2, in the second language, the larger language. Grade 3 would be, yes, there's an orthography, but there's no proof that it's been applied. You would probably, in Ethnologue, you might find dictionary or something like that. Then grade 4, this is where the Bible portions come in. That I interpret that to mean that if there is an orthography, at least it has been applied as far as elementary reading is going, put it that way. Then at level 5, I tried to quantify L1 and L2 literacy, where L2 is greater, where there's more literacy in L2, but the total is less than 50%. And then my grade 6 would be the same, but where L1 literacy is greater. So that's a little further up the scale of safety. Then my grade 7 would be L1 and L2 literacy, where L2 is greater, and the total of literacy adds up to more than 50%. More than 50. Then my grade 8 would be the same, but where L1 is in the majority. There's more literacy in L1. Again, more than 50% total. Then my grade 9 would simply be what's referred to in the sources as press and media, which implies other domains, because if you have press and media, presumably the written vernacular is being sustained. You know, it's in everyday use and people can read it and take it for granted. So I'm still working on my tentative figures, but I can tell you that I divided up by the continents continents use, as you know, ethnologues divided into continents, and I took a sample from all the continents. But to let's see now, of the endangered languages sample taken in the atlas, I found that 259 languages, which is about half of my sample, were still at level one. No literacy, no literacy at all. But for the sample languages of that are not endangered, the figure was about the same. So we didn't. It seems that literacy is not contingent on endangerment. That's one conclusion I've come to. But that doesn't mean that the figures are not relevant anyway. In my endangered language from this sample then, I found very few, only 15, were out of 525. Only 15 were at that level two, where there is an orthography, but it's not being applied. Then at my level three, I found exactly 100 languages where it is being applied. And at level four, where the language two literacy is greater than language one, but most people are illiterate, I found 38 languages. And I found a very similar figure where L1 is in the majority, but less than half the people can use the language. I found 40 languages there. And I only found 20 at my level 6, which is where where L1 is in use more, and the total is more than 50%. It was more common, though, to find, again, I was back to a figure of 37 languages in my sample, where level 2, language 2, the majority language, was more commonly the language of literacy. And the numbers among my endangered language sample, as you probably would expect, at level 8, where there is general literacy, I only found 7 of those, and last of all, the number 9, and that's a convenient point to stop, where national languages are, I found 9 at level 9. I've just been working on these figures this week, so I haven't tabulated them properly, but I hope that gives you an idea that there is no direct link between endangerment and literacy, but the finer gradations with it, I think there's food for thought there, and it's something that can be worked on the basis of the data we already have in the atlas. Thank you very much.